You may proceed.
May it please the court, Tracy Walker on behalf of the appellants. This breach of contract case arises out of a 2011 merger agreement between Metron Holdings and a subsidiary of Airbus. The appellants are the former shareholders of Metron and their agent, SRS. The case below involved Metron's pre-merger accounting treatment for a software licensing agreement Metron had with Air Services Australia. Airbus contended that Metron failed to comply with generally accepted accounting procedures in its treatment of that contract, ultimately resulting in breaches of sections 3.7, 3.10, and 9.2b4 of the merger agreement and an inaccurate valuation of Metron for purposes of the merger.
Counsel, let me interrupt you. Why doesn't the accounting error, it's the same accounting error, isn't it?
Yes, sir.
Well, why doesn't that have the same impact on all three sections of the merger agreement?
Your Honor, it does, and I believe that's an important part of our appeal. Everyone agrees that the exact same conduct, the same accounting conduct, led to the breaches of the three sections of the merger agreement, 3.7, 3.10, and 9.2b4. And not only was it the same conduct, but the trial court calculated indivisible damages arising out of that same conduct. So because of that, when you then turn to the caps on liability, the cap in 9.2C3A applies, and by the language of the merger agreement, the cap in provision C does not apply. The contract provides, and I believe it is clear from the contract, that the parties did intend for liability to be capped. Section 9.2C1 makes the agreement the sole remedy, except in cases of fraud, and 9.2B, the provision at issue here on the consideration spreadsheet that Airbus is relying on, is also subject to 9.2C. 9.2C has three caps, so the issue is which bucket do you put it in? Bucket A says that the company holders, that's the appellants, that their indemnity obligations for damages for breaches of all representations and warranties under them fundamental reps and special reps will be limited to the escrow fund, approximately $5.8 million. Everyone agrees that covers 3.7 and 3.10. But then you turn to the other cap that Airbus relies on, 9.2C3C. Provision C is a catch-all. Airbus agrees it's a catch-all. And it says that the company holder's indemnity obligations to Airbus arising under Section 9 that are not subject to the limitations described in Section 9.2C3A or Section 9.2C3B will be limited to the higher amount, approximately $55 million. So it's that phrase in the middle, that are not subject to the limitations described in A or B, that is important here. If they are subject to A or B, as this indivisible damages calculated by the trial court indisputably are, then the higher cap doesn't apply. And you reach the same result when you rely on contract construction principles, that the specific guides the general, and that you should read every part of the contract.
Section 10.6 relating to cumulative remedies have any, does that speak to those sections at all as to whether they could sue under both the general 5.8 and the larger amount?
Justice Powell, we believe it does. And Section 10.6 starts out, and I'll read the precise language of it. And this is on appendix page 1501, except as otherwise provided in section 9.2C or elsewhere in this agreement, any and all remedies in this agreement can be pursued. So yes, the contract provides for cumulative remedies subject to 9.2C, and 9.2C is specifically includes the caps. So, yes, it allows them to pursue cumulative remedies, but then you have to go back to which cap applies, and provision cap C, 9.2C3C, is limited by the language all damages that are not subject to the limitations described in A or B.
Let me ask you this. If they had just sued on the consideration spreadsheet, then a different cap would have applied, the one that the trial court used?
No, sir. If that had occurred, the position SRS would have taken, and it would have been the correct position, is that the conduct that they're alleging, even if they just put it under the label of consideration spreadsheet, it would still be what their expert witnesses described was failure to comply with GAAP, which would be a breach of 3.7 and 3.10, which would be subject to the lower cap. So you could get around it with labels.
That would still affect the consideration spreadsheet, wouldn't
it? Yes, it would, and that's why we believe those two provisions ultimately are in conflict as to these types of issues, because every time you have an accounting error under generally accepted accounting procedures that are going to cause Airbus damages, it's necessarily going to fall under 3.7 and 3.10. The parties negotiated a lower damages cap for that. They set up an escrow fund, which would make it easier for Airbus to collect its money in that circumstance. And then they set a higher cap for the consideration spreadsheet and other things that, in our estimation, the parties all agreed were very unlikely to occur. But the parties heavily negotiated this. And they were aware of the possibility of GAAP issues. They had dealt with GAAP issues. Accountants had looked at this, and they set aside a lower cap just for that purpose, in our view.
Let me ask you one more question, then I won't ask you anymore. You don't contest, do you, the amount of the damages? You're just contesting
not on appeal, Your Honor. In our third assignment of error, which the court did not accept, we did challenge the foundation of the expert witness on damages, but what is before this court right now is just the contract interpretation of the cap and also the contractual limitations.
So if the 5.8 million cap applies, you don't challenge the fact they'd be entitled to that?
We do not, Your Honor. The remedy would be, we have requested that this court would reverse and enter final judgment in the amount of the escrow cap.
What about the attorney's fees?
The attorney's fees are defined as damages in the contract, so they would be damages that would also be subject to the cap. Whatever they're entitled to as damages is subject to the cap.
Have you ever challenged that in the court below, the attorney's fees?
We specifically raised the cap as to everything, and then separately, the defendants did challenge the damages award, and it was a disputed award.
Did you challenge the award of the attorney's fees?
Yes, we did challenge the award of the attorney's fees.
As part of the damages subject to the cap?
I don't know if we specifically raised that, but it wouldn't matter because before the court awarded the attorney's fees, the actual quantum number, the court had already rejected our position that the cap applied. And the damages other than fees and costs exceeded 5.8. Metron brought it to the attention of the trial court in its motion for reconsideration. That was denied, and then the court took up the amount of fees. So at that point, any further objection when the court had already ruled that the cap didn't apply would have been futile.
Bottom line is, if you win, everything gets rolled into the 5.8, and that's the cap, and that's the final judgment.
That is our position. And we don't think it was waived in any way. It was timely raised in a motion for reconsideration immediately after the letter of opinion, and under Brandon, that is timely. Now, as to the statute of limitations issue, which it is in our estimation, it is very clearly a contractual limitations period. It's just a handful of issues. You get to the same result because but for the 9.2B4 consideration spreadsheet claim, they wouldn't have any argument that the higher cap applies. But the 9.2B4 claim was untimely because the parties agreed to a three-year period. Now, Airbus says in its opening brief in this court, in a footnote 8, I believe, that it has never conceded that the three-year period from Delaware law applies. That was not its position in its opposition to the petition, in which at page 16 of its opposition to the petition, its Airbus said, because the applicable statute of limitations is 3 years, open paren, the limitations period for breach of contract under Delaware law, close paren, close quote. It also said that in the below, in its opposition to the motion for reconsideration, and this is at appendix page 450 in Airbus's brief, it said the only termination date that applies to such claims is the three-year statute of limitations under Delaware law. This case proceeded, and Airbus took the position that the parties intended the three-year period to apply, and then it only becomes an issue of whether it's a contractual period or not. If it is a contractual period, and we certainly believe it is, then the relations back statute doesn't apply under Plautus. The Plautus case clearly applies, and I'd just like to point to one provision, Plautus. At the Plautus 776 Southeast 2nd at 797, this court said, by incorporating a period of limitations into the terms and conditions of their contract, the parties chose to exclude the operation of the statute of limitations, and doing so also excluded its exceptions. Here, the parties incorporated a period. They incorporated the statute of limitations period, not just the statute of limitations, but the statute of limitations period, which is an interval of time. The contract doesn't say 3 years, but it
under Delaware law, it's 3 years.
It's 3 years.
If we agree with you on assignment error number one, is it necessary for us to address number two?
It is not, Your Honor. And if I may, reserve the rest of my time.
All right.
Please, the court. David Google with the firm of Blankenship and Keith, co-counsel for Apple, the Airbus Americans. I'd like to introduce to the court Mr. Jeff Butler of the firm of Clifford Chance. He's a member of the State Bar, the Bar of the State of New York. He has been admitted prior to the Chance now.
All right. Mr. Butler, welcome.
May it please the court. I'm Jeff Butler for the Apple, Airbus Americas. And I want to start out by pointing out what is not on appeal. The factual findings of the trial court are no longer open to dispute. And the trial court found that because of certain accounting errors at Metron, Airbus paid $9.4 million more at closing than was required under the merger agreement. Now, that overpayment was a pure windfall.
Oh, but that's true, but that's not the issue we're dealing with. We're trying to figure out whether 3.7 and 3.10 violations can occur without simultaneously producing damages under 9.2B4. So how is that possible?
Well, let me skip ahead to that question. The liability under Section 3.7 and 3.10 and the liability for errors in the consideration spreadsheet are all separate and independent ways in which indemnification liability can arise under the merger agreement.
In theory, so you could hypothesize, although it would be hard to, but you could hypothesize gap mistakes and violations that would trigger 3.7 and 3.10 without affecting the consolidation spreadsheet, but that wasn't the claim here. The claim here was the merger price was overstated. Obviously, that's on the consolidation spreadsheet, and the reason why it was overstated is a 3.7, 3.10 violation.
It wasn't overstated because there was a 3.7 and 3.10 violation. It was restated because of the same accounting errors that flowed through a number of different documents. And the parties agreed to indemnification for errors in all of those different kinds of documents. It provided for overlapping belts and suspenders type indemnification. And we know that was the party's intent because that's what Section 10.6 of the contract says. Section 10.6 says that remedies are intended to be cumulative and not exclusive. And it says that the exercise of one remedy does not preclude the exercise of any other remedy.
Right, but so you exercise your remedy to sue on the consideration spreadsheet claim, but then the question still is different. Well, now that you've exercised your available remedy, is there in fact a escrow cap on the damages? And the unanswered question from the text of this is obviously the Weather 3.7, 3.10 capping. So tell me why this is not oversimple. Tell me why this is oversimplistic. The specific governs in general, that applies in Delaware, applies here. It's a tiebreaker principle. No one knows, in fact, what people meant to do, but that's the way we resolve ties like this.
Well, first of all, if there's a tie under the contract, there are two reasonable interpretations, and you have to go to a other means of resolving that tie. That, by definition, suggests that there's ambiguity in the contract.
Is that what the trial court held?
Pardon me?
Did the trial court make any finding on ambiguity? Did the trial court make any finding on ambiguity?
No, because the issue was never raised at trial, Your Honor. And because the issue was never raised, the trial court never had the opportunity to find ambiguity here. Now, we walked through, during the trial, we walked through the cap provisions and gave the court our interpretation of the cap provisions repeatedly. We said that only the third cap for $55 million applies to claims for errors in the consideration spreadsheet. There was no alternative theory of the cap provisions that was presented at trial. If this theory had been presented, there is parole evidence that we would have submitted to try to clarify this point. There are drafts of the merger agreements. There are contemporaneous communications. We never had the opportunity to even propose that because this argument was never made at trial. And that goes to a completely different point. Because of the way this issue was raised at trial, we believe that it affects the standard of review on appeal. This issue of the cap, this issue of the contractual statute of limitations was never made in any pleading, was never made in any pretrial motion, and it was never made at any point during the 11-day bench trial of this matter.
Can I interrupt you there? That is a great question. Have nothing, obviously, to do with cap provisions in your merger agreement. Whether or not a reconsideration request in all instances, under all cases, no matter what, preserves a matter for appeal, it seems to be colloquial wisdom that it does, but I wonder. Because if you're raising something in a motion to reconsideration that, for the purpose of preserving for appeal, that could not really be addressed without holding a bifurcated trial and starting a second trial, obviously the trial judge didn't want to do that. Then I really wonder if it is a proper preservation. Doesn't it have to be an objection when it's timely, when the trial court can do something about it? But the argument is often made to us. Well, the trial court could have. It could have held a hearing. And the average trial judge, including me when I was a trial judge, would say, no, I already tried the case. I'm not going to try it twice.
Right. Well, I completely agree with that analysis. I think when you're talking about a contractual defense, something that's in the nature of an affirmative defense, I mean, there's an argument and there's precedent in the Commonwealth that that type of defense has to be raised in a pleading, but there's a very good argument to suggest that that kind of defense has to be raised at trial, particularly when your adversary is expressing the contrary position to the court. And if that doesn't happen, as I said, the trouble is the court never had the opportunity to make a ruling on ambiguity. And if the trial court had found ambiguity, Airbus never had the opportunity to present parole evidence that would have resolved the ambiguity.
And you made that response in the trial court to the trial judge in response to the motion to reconsider.
We did not make that specific argument to the trial court. I don't believe we argued that we should be permitted to present parole evidence. We argued that their interpretation was wrong. And the trial court appears to agree.
Can I ask you something as to why a gap error in the consideration spreadsheet is more significant for purposes of damages than a gap error elsewhere? It just helped me understand the case.
Well, I think that's a very important question. The consideration spreadsheet is a document that's prepared by the sellers right before closing. And it determines the amount of money that Airbus pays at closing. It's dollars coming directly out of Airbus's pockets. So if there's any error in the consideration spreadsheet, it would have been very important for Airbus to have the protection of indemnification for the full amount of that error. And in this case, it was $9.4 million, but it could have been $20 million.
There's less time to go back behind those numbers, given on the eve of wrapping everything up, as opposed to earlier disclosures, am I right?
There are all kinds of ways there could have been errors, gap errors, other types of errors in the consideration spreadsheet. And just as a matter of logic, I could understand why the parties would have agreed that those kinds of errors that directly affect the money coming out of Airbus's pockets at closing and going into the seller's pockets at closing, should have the cap, should be capped only by the total amount of merger consideration.
So the consideration spreadsheet is a document that has a magnified importance. Is that right?
I agree, Your Honor.
To the parties, and therefore it may make sense that the same error that might creep in earlier when you can detect it in documents of lesser significance is treated differently for purposes of damages.
That's correct. The consideration spreadsheet is an extremely important document in the merger, and the representations and warranties in Section 3.7 and 3.10 relate to what they define as the company financial statements. And these are basically historical financial statements. They go back all the way to 2009, and the merger was in 2011. So you can understand that the parties would have had less concern that those types of accounting errors back in those documents would have a significant impact.
Does the timing of the error affect the amount of the error? The 3.7 and 3.10 occurred early on in the generation of documents. The spreadsheet occurs just before closing. Is the amount the same at both times?
There was no finding of any difference in the amount, but in theory, Your Honor, the amount could be slightly different because one of the accounting errors was the failure to report a reserve for future losses under the contract. That reserve, in theory, could have been different back in May of 2011 than the reserve would be in October of 2011 when the closing occurred. There was no finding of any difference. I think the court treated them as the same, but they really are two different forms of damages. And I want to go to this point. A lot of the seller's argument depends on this court accepting the idea of indivisible damages. Indivisible damages is the word that's used. These damages are not indivisible because even if there had been no overpayment at closing, under the merger agreement, Airbus still would have been entitled to indemnification for the undisclosed liabilities in the financial statements. And that's because the term damages is a defined term in the agreement, and it's very broadly inclusive. It includes any liability. So if there's an undisclosed liability in a company financial statement, Airbus is entitled for indemnification for that liability, even if it has no effect on the purchase price. So these damages are not necessarily indivisible. I think the trial court, as a matter of shorthand in her rather lengthy opinion at the end, treated them as didn't draw any distinction between the damages under the two
provisions. But wouldn't the existence of the liability change the purchase price?
Not necessarily. For example, if it's a long-term liability, it wouldn't have any impact at all on the purchase price. So if they had taken out a bank loan for a long period of time and they had not disclosed that in a company financial statement, that would not have affected the net working capital calculation in the consideration spreadsheet, but it certainly would have left Airbus with a big undisclosed liability after the merger closed.
Right, but in this particular instance, aren't, in essence, the numbers on the spreadsheet an indication of the damages which occurred because of the violations of 3.7 and 3.10?
The same error was propagated into that document, but I don't think they're necessarily an indication of errors that occurred earlier. They could have done the company financial statements correctly. I mean, the error could have arisen between the time of the last company financial statement and the consideration spreadsheet. That wasn't the case here because the error was in all of these documents.
I'm talking about this particular instance.
Yeah. No, in this particular instance, it's true that the same accounting mistakes infected the financial statements, and the company financial statement really is a balance sheet of the company, which is one of the company financial statements. There are other company financial statements as well. So it's in all three.
I don't want to go around in circles, but help me understand. I thought that under the first one, they had not accounted properly for the money they received from the Australian company, the $3 million, whatever it is.
Correct.
Then I thought under the second one, they had not considered this a lost income kind of deal. So you had development costs that were not revealed. Now that's two different things, isn't it?
That's correct. One was a revenue was recognized prematurely that should have been
deferred. But my point is, those combination of those two, which they don't really, I gather, don't challenge, could have exceeded $5.8 million.
Oh, absolutely. And as I said,
how do we say that the $5.8 million covers all the damages?
Well, it doesn't in this case because there's no remaining contest that we were harmed by $9.4 million plus all the attorney's fees we had to spend.
Tell me about the attorney's fees. How do you get past their argument that it's just part of the damages?
I don't think we get past that argument, Your Honor. I think that it is part of the damages, and Mr. Walker was correct that if our liability is capped, then we can't recover the attorney's fees. We're limited to $5.8 million. But, Your Honor, our liability is not capped, and that's if I leave you with one thought here in my last minute, it's that when you look at the plain language of Section 9.2C3, the cap provisions are all framed in terms of indemnity obligations. Each of the provisions is a sentence, consists of a subject and a verb. The subject is indemnity obligations, and the verb is will be limited. So the only thing limited by those provisions are indemnity obligations. And as we know from Section 10.6, you can have overlapping, cumulative, non-exclusive indemnity obligations. There's no way to read the sentences in Section 9.2C3 as limiting the word damages. So the sellers are really trying to rewrite that provision in a last-ditch effort to salvage the situation in a motion to reconsider, to really make damages the subject of those provisions. And where I respectfully submit, the plain language shows that only indemnity obligations are limited. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you. Rebuttal, you have 2 minutes, 37 seconds.
Quick, Your Honor. As to the ambiguity issue, that was never raised in the trial court. And the trial court was given an opportunity to rule on this in a properly, timely filed motion for reconsideration. And it was right because the trial court ruled in Metron's favor on some claims, including one claim that this was a government contract subject to a $15 million cap. And that was a 3.28C claim, special representation claim that might have invoked a different cap.
Can you turn your attention to the use of the expression indemnity in 9.2?
I'm sorry.
Can you turn your attention to the use of the expression indemnity in 9.2?
Yes, sir.
And address the argument that was just made.
Well, the language in 9.2C3, there's a grammatical argument in the briefs about which word modifies which word, but their reading of it would remove, if I can get to 9.2C3, would remove the word damages. And these are liability caps which relate to damages. In particular, it's the language indemnity obligations arising under Section 9, indemnity obligations to indemnify persons for all damages arising under Section 9 that are not subject to the limitations described in A or B. Their reading of it would read out the word all damages and just say indemnity obligations covered under C that are not covered under A or B. And there is an argument about the grammar. But the court did have a chance to rule. There was no issue of ambiguity ever raised before now, essentially, in the opening brief. It was raised as an alternative. The argument below was that the contract...
Why does that matter? I mean, we can rule on an alternative legal ground to sustain the court's judgment.
If this court were to find it ambiguous, but it's relevant because they said the trial court didn't have an opportunity to rule. The trial court, it was ripe at that time for the trial court to rule. Justice McCullough, as to your question, the consideration spreadsheet was traded back and forth during the closing day. Airbus had drafts of it. They had access to all of this, and that doesn't rise to any presumption under the agreement, but all of this was known to them, and there was even a correction period for the consideration spreadsheet. So this did not have some special significance. It was something that was worked out over an extended time by the parties to the contract. And I see that my time is used up.
Call the next case.